last presentation was looking at sort of a shift from charity to justice, but integrating both. And our next presentation with Todd Ferguson is going to look at primary health care as decent care, a normative shift in the delivery of care, perhaps from an optimal framework to a decent framework, but I will have to wait to find out. Todd is working with the American Medical Association Institute for Ethics, and additionally, he has his MA and his PhD in philosophy and has been a research associate at the AMA Institute. Prior to this, he worked in a health science research firm, so also has an interesting multi-experiential background, and he's worked with the WHO on the concept of decent care, has authored a book on the subject, and provided and moderated two global consultations on the subjects. And with that, and with support from the Ford Foundation, as I understand.
Right.
And with that, Todd Ferguson.
Thank you.
The less important disclosure, I have no financial relationship to disclose, but the more important one is that this has nothing to do with the AMA. So I'm here not as an employee of the American Medical Association. This is completely outside of my work with them, so this is kind of a way to recharge my philosophical karma by working at the AMA in some ways. There is an unprecedented healthcare crisis, as we all know, at global, national, and local levels, leaving millions without basic care or with insufficient care. Most current healthcare models have often ignored, excluded, or muted the voices of the people they were intended to serve. Such exclusion has created health systems and healthcare delivery models that give neither proper attention nor response to the needs of the people. These systems and models are not decent. They do not fully care about the people they care for. At its core, decent care offers a new approach to healthcare delivery and quality by encouraging communities to develop their own healthcare delivery models and governments to build responsible, equitable, and sustainable health systems. Decent care aims to return to the very heart of the caring process by basing the planning, delivery, and evaluation of care on values that place individuals in their social and cultural contexts at the center of the caring process. As care seeking and care providing are relational activities between individuals and their families and communities, it is important to emphasize the fundamental values that should be upheld and embodied in the delivery of decent care: agency and dignity, interdependence and solidarity, and subsidiarity and sustainability. The aims of decent care are to develop health systems around the primacy of persons in healthcare and to build a bridge between the idealism of human rights and the practice of medicine. By listening to and honoring the voices of the people, care processes and models can be developed that are responsive to individuals' needs, actualize rights to access and universal care, and strive towards the greater goal of identifying and responding to the needs of a community to enable human flourishing. The activity of caregiving, of caring for another, is a comprehensive ideal that should be conceived inclusively and holistically as the work of providing treatment services and attending to the medical, physiological, psychological, and spiritual needs of another. It is important to determine how the ideal of caring is realized in the concrete activities, practices, and models of providing care and treatment services for others. As Joan Tronto, author of Moral Boundaries, states, caring suggests an alternative moral attitude. From the perspective of caring, what is important is not arriving at the fair decision, understood as how the abstract individual in the situation would want to be treated, but at meeting the needs of particular others or preserving relationships of care that exist. In this way, moral theory becomes much more closely connected to the needs of others. Decent care offers a new normative approach to the provision of care, of meeting the needs of particular others, that is unique from, but improves on, a current contemporary model of care, primary health care. The burgeoning primary health care movement of the 1960s reached global recognition with the Declaration of Alma Ata in 1978. Specifically, the Declaration spells out the fundamental essence of primary health care. It is essential health care based on practical, scientifically sound, and socially acceptable methods and technology made universally acceptable to individuals and families in the community through their full participation and at a cost that the community and country can afford to maintain at every stage of their development in a spirit of self-reliance and self-determination. The renewal of the primary healthcare movement in recent years has stressed the importance of putting people at the center of care. To this end, primary healthcare identifies several key values, most notably social justice, the right to better health for all, participation, and solidarity, that focus on fundamentally changing how health systems are designed and operate and account for what people consider desirable ways of living as individuals and what they expect from their societies. The goal of the primary healthcare movement is nothing short of designing and implementing people-centered health systems that respond better and faster to the ongoing challenges of a changing and globalizing world. What is lacking from the primary healthcare movement, however, are the concrete steps in actually placing and sustaining individuals and communities at the center of the care processes. And this is where decent care can complement and help achieve primary healthcare's overall goal of tailoring healthcare to a community's specific needs and giving balanced consideration to the health and well-being, as well to the values and capacities of the population and the health workers. The model of decent care is consistent with the overall framework of the primary healthcare movement. Like the primary healthcare movement, decent care contends that the provision of care must be driven by the needs and demands of care recipients, and that insufficient recognition of the human dimension in health and of the need to tailor the health services response to the specificity of each community and individual situation represent a major shortcoming in contemporary healthcare. Situating and sustaining individuals at the center of their care processes enables the aim of primary healthcare to become a pragmatic and realizable goal that the voices, needs, and decisions of care recipients decisively influence the way in which health services are designed and operate. Decent care develops within or grows out of the intersection of three things: of a community's contextual issues, for example, the stage of the sickness and wellness in the community, specific institutional barriers to access to care. Secondly, the community's core values, for example, agency, dignity, interdependence, sustainability. And thirdly, the community's operational parameters, for example, the qualitative and quantitative measures of performance. In this important way, what defines or constitutes decent care for a community are the particular contexts and needs defined by the community, the core values identified, understood, and lived by the community, the operational parameters and indicators constructed and used by the community, and most importantly, how the community integrates these elements into their own system or approach to the provision of care. And it is precisely within this type of organic process that primary health care can thrive. First, a move toward health equity, social justice, and universal access to care. Second, to make health services more responsive by organizing them around people's concrete needs and expectations. Third, to promote multi-sectoral cooperation and partnership. And fourth, to make healthcare and healthcare reform a more inclusive and participatory process. At WHO's Alma Ata Conference in 1978, participants affirmed in the declaration that health, which is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, is a fundamental human right, and that the attainment of the highest possible level of health is a most important worldwide social goal whose realization requires the action of many other social and economic sectors in addition to the health sector. The aim of engagement in the life of a community and in one's own health is the enhancement of human flourishing, that individuals and communities will have the opportunity to grow, thrive, achieve success, and ideally prosper. And human flourishing begins with building healthy people. Healthy neighborhoods and communities and healthy nations can and will stimulate the human experience and ideally strengthen ties of shared humanity. Decent care and primary healthcare movement are founded on the core value that all humans are active agents who should be at the center of their own care processes. that every human being can, in their own capacity, flourish and live a dignified, meaningful life that is respected and recognized by others. Our capacity to flourish demands that we each direct our own health and the care that we receive. Thus, the ultimate goal of decent care, of primary health care as a form of decent care, is not health for health's sake, but health for some greater end and purpose, health striving towards human flourishing. As a closing note, we just found out recently that WHO and the Princess Diana Foundation, as well as several other non-governmental organizations, have given money to fund several pilot sites in Africa to actually implement this process and then do some M&E following that in 2010. And since this is a very brief exposition of a much longer paper, I also have copies of the second paper that was commissioned by the WHO and funded by the Ford Foundation available with me. It's also available in 5 UN languages if you're so interested. So, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Why don't you all come up and sort of gather around, but not necessarily sit down. So decent care is definitely an augmentation concept, not a diminutive concept, and beautifully discussed. I have a question that maybe pull together Michael and Todd. One of the words that you had on one of the slides was subsidiarity, which has a very rich tradition. So I'd like for you maybe to discourse a little bit or discuss how subsidiarity might fit in with the idea of temporary brigades and so forth, and how you would see this sort of working together if there were persons or groups coming into this context, how you would see those to integrate into the kind of decent care that you're looking for. So, Michael, would you like to?
Sure. So, yeah, I think it fits quite well. In terms of health worker subsidiarity, having the least trained person who can do a job well do it would kind of fit into that concept. And my experience has been that the medical brigades and other things that that I've been a part of is that there are certain things that are not transferable. So you can't push down cleft palate surgery and other kind of advanced medical procedures can't be. But when you can emphasize kind of that idea of subsidiarity, as I mentioned, doing intake, doing blood pressure work, showing the various clinical symptoms that can be referred, then I think that we're obligated to be doing that. And it increases the training of local health providers and allows them to do the things that they actually can do and enhances their status in the community as a health provider rather than diminishing it because all of a sudden they're not as good as the high-income providers coming in.
I think that's something I couldn't say it better. I think that's exactly kind of what we envisioned as well, but that too often needs are determined not at the local level where they should be. It's trying to determine how to mitigate where that decision is made, but I think too often or not that those needs are not determined by and then acted upon by the community at that level. So,
we have a model a bit for that in the U.S. in the Indian Health Service, where back in the 70s, I don't know if it's still going on, they were training these 10-week training programs for folks to go back into the community. So these very rural areas where there were no health workers. They were also given communication devices, radio devices in those days, so you could actually get primary care. You know, they'd have antibiotics in their toolkit, and they'd learn how to suture and do other things of primary sort of triage care, and then they would call into the different Indian health service centers for advice. So if it was something they hadn't gotten in their 10 weeks, they'd call in for advice. And then if it was something they couldn't handle, they'd be transported into Bethel or Kotzebue or Anchorage, to the Alaska Native Service Hospital. So it's been done in some places, for sure. And I don't know if that has been duplicated elsewhere.
Well, I have another question. I could tie the two vaccine nation context together, but I'll let other people ask questions, so please.
Actually, this comment is for Abigail. Were you aware that from the public health nursing section that they had put forth a resolution about mandatory healthcare worker vaccination for seasonal flu, and there's actually quite a bit of opposition to that, and it was tabled. And actually, it's going to be rewritten for next year, and I think I wrote your email down correctly, and I'll put you in touch with
Great.
The primary author of that. But yeah, it's kind of ironic.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, and there's a lot of discussion about this right now, and obviously certain organizations are more supportive of mandates
mm-hmm.
than others. And so, but I appreciate your comment, and I'd like to take a look at that.
Well, what's so interesting to me, I'm a nurse, that even to get back into graduate school, you
mm-hmm.
had to have, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, you had to have varicella, you had to
mandates
have
mandates are not new in
right,
case.
Right.
Exactly.
And so it's like, why is this one so different? That's incongruent. But I will be sure I have your email address correct.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Were there any arguments that were different than the ones that Abigail mentioned?
I was only present in the public health nursing section business meeting for, I guess, two discussions about that, and I guess, and I'm new to APHA, so I don't understand the whole structure about, so when the resolution went to where it would be voted on, there was actually another section that was very, very opposed to this. They had missed the timeline,
mm-hmm.
and I'm reporting this from somebody who reported it to me, they missed the timeline to send comments to JPC, but they had a five-page document on, I guess, 200 people's thing this morning with the top header in large print, vote no. Interesting.
But most healthcare institutions have what they call respiratory hygiene in effect during the flu season from October to March, which means that if the healthcare worker has a URI, they wear a mask. If the patient is coughing and sneezing, the healthcare worker wears a mask. So I'm wondering if perhaps this would negate the need for mandatory vaccinations and perhaps preserve the autonomy of the staff.
Can anyone? Do you want me to? Does somebody else have a comment? I'll let someone else comment if they'd like to.
I guess I could take that in.
Sure.
On the three, first of all, I am always been a big advocate of healthcare workers getting vaccinated, except necessarily
mm-hmm.
for H1N1. Because of the severe shortage of vaccine, I've actually been advocating that it should go to high-risk, high-exposure people. So the pregnant healthcare worker, the pregnant school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and the kids with neurological problems.
Right.
Since flu is here, and we don't have enough vaccine to give it to all the healthcare workers and everybody to prioritize right now before healthcare worker.
Right, and that's a little bit of what's going on in New York. From what I've read, there's two different types of opposition and why the mandate has been tabled in New York. First being the opposition that was waged by two unions and a group of nurses for the autonomy argument that this woman just articulated. And then the other one is there is a vaccine shortage. And so New York State, as I understand it, has recommended that the vaccine be prioritized. And I'd also like to comment on your what you had mentioned about the medical exceptions, medical religious exceptions. There is, in some of the mandates, there's two different types of mandates I think we can talk about here. There's the mandates where there's only medical exceptions, and there's the mandates that allow for the religious or philosophical objections. And in those cases, accommodations are offered, like wearing the masks. What's interesting is I was talking to someone about this, and they said, you know, the easiest way to get someone to get vaccinated is to offer them the accommodation to wear a mask throughout the entire influenza season. All of a sudden, vaccination doesn't seem so bad. And I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, because I realize that there's real issues and real reasons why people do not want to get vaccinated. And people are concerned about their autonomy and their personal choice, which I certainly respect, but I think we've gotten to the point where this public health issue has to overcome, on behalf of patient safety, healthcare workers' choice.
Right. And the reason that just putting on, well, first of all, if a healthcare worker is sick, they shouldn't be working because of the mask isn't going to do it. But even if you were going to have only wear the mask if you start to feel sick or, well, first of all, you're talking about when the healthcare worker is very early symptomatic, mm-hmm. and you're not sure if you're sick or not yet, or that first sneeze or that little cough, that could easily just be, is this your allergies or is this cough or whatever, and they may be contagious in that very early stage. And so where I've had the biggest problem is you have these nursing homes where you have all of these vulnerable mm-hmm. individuals for whom they can get vaccinated, but they're not going to be immune from that vaccine. And someone can just come in and go around and be sick or be just starting to be sick and potentially spread their disease. So that's why the automatic wearing, unless you're going to wear the mask for the whole flu season.
And healthcare organizations that implement the mandates do require that.
Yeah, but that's
because
a lot
of that issue.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Chair, please.
I'm going to ask you if you can move a little bit to a different population, but
sure.
make a correlation.
Sure.
With regard to mandating vaccine in a community such as a university setting,
okay.
where obviously it's not healthcare workers, but it's every employee as well as every student who has
mm-hmm.
close contact in a confined environment. And any thoughts in that regard?
That's an interesting scenario. I would say, and of course, and I may change my mind in a few weeks, but I would say right now, you know, the major point in my presentation was that healthcare workers choose their profession and therefore choose to accept the benefits and the burdens that come along with it. In that case, because they have close patient contact. And so in that case, I would say that mandating for at universities or colleges, where, although there's close contact, because those students, I guess you could make the argument that they're choosing to go to that particular university, and I think that could stand. But I would say at this point, and it was just sticking with the theme of healthcare workers, that's where it's most appropriate at this time.
Actually, I think healthcare workers do not enter the profession to help people. They help me to get $45 an hour.
But
and I think that's why we're seeing a difference in healthcare workers than when I train, which is what I said when they asked you. But they're not there for that. They're there for the money.
You may be right, and we could argue that either way, and so people have different motivations, but I would still say that they choose to enter the profession, and because of that, they choose whether or not to accept the benefits or burdens that come along with it. And if they choose not to get vaccinated, then I would also argue that they should also be willing to accept whatever consequences are associated with that.
Yeah, Elise, do you see any parallels with insurance employees?
Oh, God.
Would the system be better off if they were all sick?
I think what Elisa's data shows is we need the single payer healthcare. Then it wouldn't
perhaps,
be a problem at all.
You know, but
one
that single system might not be so good. You don't know. It better be good.
Yeah, if it's the only game in town, if you're going to skydive with one parachute, it better be a good one. Yeah.
Quality measures for it.
You know, the other thing is autonomy as a word is not a justification, okay? There has to be something else beyond it than just to say, I want the right to choose, because there are many times in life where we don't have the right to choose, and we have to therefore use some other means of philosophical argument or practical argument to justify or to explain why we should or should not have the right to choose. So, when people just use that as sort of a trump card, it doesn't work. Particularly, it's curious within helping professions where there's supposed to be some form of altruism included. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be, you know, supererogatory altruism, but there's supposed to be some form of concern about the other as opposed to just simple concern about ourselves.
This is an interesting situation. First, I am in healthcare, and I didn't enter it for $45 an hour. I think that's a pretty unfair judgment to say that the new generation doesn't have a good heart in their approach. I am also working in mental health, so I'm a university graduate student while working at the university as well, and was told since, because of my age, that I should be getting the kind of in this catch-22 because I feel like since I'm a mental health worker and I'm not necessarily working in a hospital setting, I'm working with outpatient mental health, that I may not be at the greatest risk and I may actually be using up a resource for a vaccine where I may not be at the greatest risk or someone else could benefit more than I could from it right now as well, you know, since there's a shortage of it. So I'm kind of in this deciding mode right now. I have to decide this in the coming week of whether or not I should be getting the vaccine or not, and it's not mandatory. I don't think for anyone at the University of Pennsylvania right now, but it's just kind of this, what do I do? You know, so I'm just putting that out there that there is kind of, it's not necessarily just the autonomy of it or the I want my right to choose as much as it is, am I the most, would I benefit the most from this versus someone else who could maybe have a greater benefit right now?
But part of the argument that we were having with, and I was working for the New York State Department of Health when we had the vaccine shortage several years ago, showing my age now. And that was the exact argument we had for a marked drop in the number of healthcare providers who received the vaccine. And that actually exacerbated the situation. We have a lack of data, of good data, that shows, you know, how effective healthcare workers are as a vector, except in limited situations like a nursing home or a long-term care facility. The problem is those data show that rationing the vaccine and giving it to the most vulnerable does nothing. Giving it to the healthcare workers increases or reduces morbidity and mortality over twofold. And we have a lack of data on this situation. But we also have the problem of conflating issues here as well, because in your situation, I would argue that we also have to look at sort of, do we want to prioritize the vaccine for people who, in the event of a really bad pandemic, we need you to be able to be available, seconded, to take care of desperately sick people, and thus maintain our public health and healthcare infrastructure. So I think there's a real balance going on here, and I just worry about this vulnerability argument that is often bandied about, that we need to save for the most vulnerable, because we have to look at longer term goals as well. But it's challenging.
Let me do maybe two more comments, and then we'll adjourn, and we can continue discussing here, and then you can have a little break, and then bandy your way down to this big business meeting.
And then we'll talk about over drinks.
Right, but for this one, for instance, I had influenza last week, and I'm almost certain, so now I'm better than I am. And I am going to, by the way, get the vaccine at the end of the line when we're swimming in it, but I'm not going to get it as soon as I possibly can to save it. So right now, when this particular outbreak, we're not going to have this, not having any healthcare workers to do the work, because there's going to be time that healthcare workers can get better. Everybody's not getting sick at the exact same time.
Okay, one more comment.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this angst around taking the vaccine is the fact that influenza is at this point perceived as something you go home, you go to bed, you get up, you get better the next day. That it's not perceived as serious illness because there's nobody in this room or in this country that was here for the Spanish influenza in 1918. I've had H1N1. You don't want this. Okay, you don't want this. It's not the flu. It's not just the flu. You're tired. It's bad. But my point being, you know, I'm asking you the question. If H1N1 looked more like bird flu, or if it looked more like SARS, would we be having this conversation? And is it really about perceptions of the disease as opposed to perceptions of the vaccine?
As to why people are not getting vaccinated.
Are reticent to take it. If I told you you were going to get Spanish influenza, turn blue in 2 days and die, you may have a different focus around the urgency of taking the vaccine.
Right. I think that point's very well taken. I also think that there's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings out there on vaccines, on influenza vaccines. Google influenza vaccine and you'll see them all. I mean, there's a lot out there. There's a lot of misunderstandings, incorrect information, and healthcare workers are part of that. Healthcare workers are not always sure of what the influenza vaccine can do to help their patients or can do to help them. And so that's particularly problematic. And so I think starting by educating healthcare workers will really help with this, educating them that vaccines are the first line of defense, that they are efficacious, that they are, in fact, in most cases, safe. I think starting with the healthcare workers, they can communicate this to their patients.
Okay. And with that, we'll thank you all for coming and for our excellent and interesting panel. Thank you.
Okay, that's great. Well, and actually, I was going to say here, that there's a difference between the two things.
They're actually putting it together.